Sup, freaks? It's your boy Marty here to introduce this rip of TFTC. Thank you for joining us. Give this video a like. Subscribe to the channel. If you catch us on podcast apps, make sure you subscribe there. Give us a rating, a review. Go to tftc.io as well. Become a member of the site. Join the conversation. Truth for the commoner, trying to get you the high signal content in a world gone mad. This rip was brought to you by good friends at River. River's here to make it as easy as possible for you to buy Bitcoin and then take it into self-custody. Go to river.com/TFTC, set up an account today, and you'll get $5 of Bitcoin after you buy $100 worth of Bitcoin on River. You can dollar cost average into Bitcoin with no fees. If you're just buying one off, River has the best fees in the industry. They back all their Bitcoin reserves one-to-one in multi-sig cold storage. They highly recommend that you take self-custody. They just introduced limits. So if you want to set a limit order below or above the current Bitcoin price, River makes that extremely easy as well. They also have real customer support. You can pick up the phone and call them if you have any questions about your experience on River. So go to river.com/TFTC, set up an account today. Enjoy this rip.
Gentlemen, welcome to the show. This is a great quad box we got here. I'm very honored to be sitting with you three gentlemen on this beautiful Monday morning.
Right. Thanks for having us. This is awesome. Yeah, really excited to get this group together. It's long, long overdue.
3 years overdue. So the reason we're meeting today is an article going over the Bitcoin stack that the three of you collaborated on, which stems from a Bitcoin 2021 conference presentation that Drew and Ryan gave in Miami about the Bitcoin stack. And I think it is, having read the piece a couple times now, I think it's really pivotal what you guys are honing in on, which is for Bitcoin to succeed and to actually bring utility to the world and scale appropriately, you have to have these market incentives that exist at every layer. And so I think a big part of the conversation, what we're going to talk about today, is the different layers of Bitcoin and how the incentive systems that exist on those different layers enable Bitcoin to actually work in any form or fashion. And before we jump in to the broader conversation, defining each layer, how the incentive works, is there any more context that any of you would like to add?
Maybe we could talk a little bit about how we even got here. So Ryan and I, indeed, were collaborating for a long time on these kinds of ideas. I think Ryan shaped a lot of my thinking around how decentralized really means market-driven, which I really tried to run with. We gave this talk in 2021. It was fairly well-received, but a little cerebral and only like 20 minutes or so of time. So we moved at a pretty fast pace. I think Alan reached out to Ryan and I shortly thereafter being like, hey, this was a great talk. I really want you guys to write this up. I'm even willing to help you write it up. I don't even need my name on it. Like, Alan was just very generous with his time and his support. And then it took us, for some reason, 3 years to get to this point. So that's, I think that's mostly on me and perhaps Ryan to a degree, like feeling busy, you know, with our work responsibilities and our quote unquote day jobs, supporting our businesses. But I really want to thank publicly Alan for his persistence and his patience, helping us get here, and then his support in actually writing up an article that hopefully is coming out soon that kind of is a more extended take on the kind of themes and ideas Ryan and I were talking about back in 2021. So thank you, Alan.
Yeah, totally want to echo the thanks and the push, and really excited to revisit these ideas. I think one additional point of context, it's just, you know, because this was a 2021 talk, this was at a point where, and I remember actually Dhruv and I chatting about like whether we should include this in the presentation. We're like, this was kind of peak Bitcoin versus Ethereum, and kind of, you know, maybe is this the cycle that Ethereum flips Bitcoin? Right. I remember just specifically talking with Dhruv about like, should we talk about that? And like, maybe I even mentioned it as like a hypothetical. And I think kind of the kind of peak disagreement between those two cultural camps was kind of what we were trying to reconcile a little bit, where we were trying to say like, you know, one, we think all the things that Ethereum wants to build with kind of world computer, blah, 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 blah. Like if those actually, if there's value for those things in the world, they will be built on the Bitcoin stack. And two, kind of Bitcoiners, these Ethereum people with their crazy high-minded ideas and blah, 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 like they just are, you know, economically misguided, right? They just don't understand the order of operations to building out this stack. They're trying to go straight to the very end, like the you know, the people in the dot-com bubble that tried to build Webvan 20 years too early before the infrastructure was ready. Like we should instead try and, instead of shunning them and saying all this stuff is never going to happen, try and instead kind of educate about like, oh no, you like that's, you may be a little early. That's a little crazy, but we do think you'll be able to build this on Bitcoin, and the Bitcoin is the right home for these ideas eventually.
Yeah. And it's funny in the piece, the analogy is to the show Silicon Valley, where you had Guilfoyle, the hardcore Bitcoin maxi, who is basically for modularity and simplicity. And then you had the founder of the company, his name's escaped me right now, who wanted to build the world computer, recreate the internet from scratch, which is, I think, what a lot of people would like to get to. Is there are hyper-centralized points of the internet stack that do need to be further distributed to make sure that it is permissionless and this super highway for information that anybody can access and utilize. And to your point, Ryan, it's how do we get there? What are the order of operations? And I think what you guys have honed in on is this is tech enabled in a way, but it's really market structure. It's dual faceted. It's dependent on the tech, and that tech enables these market incentives, and then you build in a modular layered fashion to actually get the end result that you want, which is a better, freer internet at the end of the day. And so with that, I think it would be advantageous to begin jumping into how does Bitcoin do this, and starting at layer zero, and how does a market form at layer zero? What is layer zero? What is the take and the ask there? And we'll throw that to Dhruv, because I know this is your bread and butter.
Yeah, I think longtime listeners, Marty, of your podcast might have heard me already talking about this just a month or two ago when I was on your show. Again, I think part of the reason it's taken so long to get here is I tend to be really long-winded, and certainly in my writing, often in my speaking, apologies. And I just put out an article a couple months ago talking about, you know, how did Satoshi think of Bitcoin and kind of tracing some of the early history. And in that article, I do kind of introduce this terminology of Bitcoin itself as a protocol slash market slash project already consists of two layers, at least two layers. There's what I call layer zero, which I believe is the market for the release of Bitcoin into circulation in a fair and equitable way. And I think there's layer one, which is the market for the settlement of transactions, for the inclusion of transactions into blocks. And we think of those markets, it's hard to distinguish those markets sometimes because they sort of settle together in some ways. The miner, you know, who wins a block gets paid both the block subsidy as well as all transaction fees at the same time. And it's proof of work that sort of extends the blockchain and serves as the way that we both of these markets settle. So it's easy to confuse them, but I think they have very different semantics. And what I argue in the piece is that we should think of them as separate because they do work differently. And moreover, it teaches us that if Bitcoin itself needed to be made as two different markets, that really there's a hint at a methodology going on here behind the scenes, which is, you can't just take a very complex problem like, for example, building a new decentralized money or perhaps building a new decentralized internet. You can't just solve it with one market and hope that that's going to, you know, work. You really need to break the problem down into sub-problems that are small enough that a market can actually solve them. Because markets are powerful, but they're not all powerful. And so we as designers of decentralized systems need to break our problems down into pieces that markets can really solve for us. And so to now go into those two markets very briefly, the market zero, which I described earlier as the market for the release of Bitcoin into circulation, this is a market, I argue, between two part. Markets are always characterized by trades, at least in the framework that I wrote about. And a trade always has two participants, and there's always something being traded on each side, and there's a price and a settlement process. And so you can kind of try to identify all those structures for Bitcoin in layer zero and layer one. And so at layer zero, the two participants in the market are the entire Bitcoin network on one side and the entire global mining industry on the other side. And I mean that in particular, it's not individual miners and it's not individual Bitcoin users. It's really these two aggregates trading with each other. That's the, what I believe the market structure looks like at layer zero. The trade that they're executing is the release of the block subsidy in exchange for the computations that go into the proof of work that produces each block. The price that that trade occurs at is denominated roughly in Bitcoin per hash. So there's a certain amount of Bitcoin you as the global mining industry will receive for a certain amount of computations or hashes that they sell to the Bitcoin network. And really, that's the way I like to think about it. I think it's a little bit of a misnomer and an unfortunate one that we use this phrase mining to describe the production of, even that phrase, the production of Bitcoin. Bitcoins are mined. It makes it sound like they're being made by the miners somehow, or they're being found out there in the world by the miners. Yes, it's an analogy to gold, and I understand that's how we got here, but I don't like that terminology. I really would prefer to think of it as the Bitcoin network is selling those Bitcoins to the miners in exchange for their computations. I think that's a more rational and correct way to describe what's actually happening at the level of this market trade. There's a couple reasons I like that. Number one, it helps underscore the idea that the Bitcoins already exist. They're not being made every 10 minutes. They were created in 2009. Satoshi created a monetary policy that the rest of us are now voluntarily executing by choosing to run Bitcoin node software. I also think the semantics here does matter in terms of negative reactions to Bitcoin, maybe from the environmentalist crowd or whomever. Because let's try to forget that we're all Bitcoiners and we understand this and value Bitcoin. Let's just say, you know, if someone came to you and said, hey, there's this good in the world, and over time, as we get better and better at making it, it costs us more and more energy to do so, and we make fewer and fewer of the good. Like, that's a weird negative kind of efficiency of scale, right? Like, how is that possible? That doesn't make any sense at all. But that's, I think, how a lot of people perceive Bitcoin mining, because they think of it as Bitcoin miners are producing Bitcoins with ever more energy at ever a higher unit cost. And that just seems inefficient and wasteful. But conversely, if you think of it as they're not making the coins, Bitcoin miners are buying the coins from the Bitcoin network, really the cost increase is just a reflection of market demand and supply. That the supply is diminishing, the demand is increasing, Bitcoin is more useful as a currency every year or every cycle, and therefore the value of Bitcoin in the real world, whether denominated in dollars or denominated in computations or denominated in energy, all of these prices should be increasing just through the normal laws of supply and demand. And so if we frame it this way, it actually makes a lot of sense that it takes more and more hash rate to buy less and less Bitcoin over time because Bitcoin is becoming more dear. And so I really like this framing of what is happening in the market between these two aggregates. Should I pause here or should I kind of roll right into layer one?
Well, I think we should pause and touch on the market making process that is inherent in the protocol with the difficulty adjustment, because I think that's a very important aspect. I think we would all agree it's one of the most important aspects of this layer zero market is this calibration of the price to get the Bitcoin that the network is putting up for sale with the amount of computation that is coming onto or leaving the network at any given point in time. It really makes it so this is actually viable and can handle fluctuations in the amount of hash that is being dedicated to the network at any given point in time.
Right. So maybe let me briefly get into that. You're right. I totally skipped over that very important and kind of central and interesting part of Bitcoin. In fact, in the article that I published a couple months ago talking about how Satoshi came up with Bitcoin, I think I mentioned that previous to that research and that article, I was very much of the mind that the difficulty adjustment, which is, of course, what you're referring to, Marty, is the most interesting and cool and novel and innovative part of Bitcoin's design. That's very much what I thought. I still think it's very innovative, and I still think it's cool, but it's less mysterious and brilliant to me, because in my view, Satoshi thought that they were auctioning off a fixed supply of Bitcoin, and they wanted to do it on a fixed time schedule. right? It's supposed to take a certain number of years, I think around 140 years or so, to exhaust the entire 21 million Bitcoin supply, rather to release it into circulation. It's a fixed monetary schedule of release. Once you have that concept in your mind that you want to release these coins on a fixed schedule, the notion that you should limit or regulate the rate in time at which that auction, every block is an auction, and in some sense, it's a trade, right, between miners and the Bitcoin network, it becomes very natural to restrict the rate in time at which that auction occurs. And that's, I think, a unique idea that Satoshi brought to Bitcoin that was driven by the notion of the finite monetary policy that Satoshi wanted to put into play. From this market perspective, you can think of difficulty readjustment as a process of market making, right? The Bitcoin network, as I kind of just discussed, is selling a certain amount of Bitcoin right now. It just cut in half a couple weeks ago. It's selling a certain amount of Bitcoin every 10 minutes, right, by design, in order to meet the predetermined monetary schedule, predetermined release schedule that Satoshi designed in 2009. The market needs to measure how long it's actually taking miners to meet the ask that the network puts out. So in some sense, the blocks that miners contribute, like the mining industry as a whole, the blocks that they contribute every, you know, approximately 10 minutes or so, are really in their own sense a kind of bid, right? That the global mining industry, over a period of 2 weeks, the average bid might be slightly less than 10 minutes or slightly more than 10 minutes. And so in response to that variance in the bidding of how long it takes the mining industry to meet the network's ask, the Bitcoin network adjusts its price. It changes the difficulty, which is literally changing the price at which Bitcoin are being sold in this auction, in order to make sure that the last round of bids moves closer towards the target value of 10 minutes. And I think brilliant idea, and it's a very unique and novel idea in Bitcoin, but it's less mysterious because I think it's a natural idea once you think of the situation as I'm trying to sell a certain amount of coins on a fixed schedule. Well, of course, you need to regulate the rate at which the market is buying those coins.
Yeah, I was in New York for the halving a couple of weeks ago, and I was at PubKey. Two nights in a row. The first night, somebody was asking about a relatively new Bitcoiner who didn't understand the difficulty adjustment. And when I explained it to him, and he wanted to know all the details. So I was like, how does a block even get mined? So when we're talking about this market for hashes, what allows you to actually purchase newly distributed Bitcoin is finding a particular hash below the target at any given, wherever the target is at any given point in time. He was like, oh, that makes sense. But like, so that it's a target, it's moving. And I explained every 2016 blocks, the network looks to see how much hash rate has come on or come off the network. It calculates that by looking at how quickly or slowly the blocks came in, then it adjusts the target. And that was an aha moment for this gentleman. He's like, oh, now it makes a lot of sense. Because I do think without the context of the difficulty adjustment, people just see this hash rate growth, this energy consumption growth, and they say, oh my gosh, this is a runaway system. But this market making process with the difficulty adjustment is essential to making sure there's some sort of equilibrium in terms of how Bitcoin's actually being distributed and staying on that 10 minute block production target.
Weren't there headlines around the time we did this presentation, or maybe a little bit earlier, that by, you know, this time the entire world's energy generation would be consumed by the Bitcoin network, right?
It was supposed to be this year, I believe, 2024.
Yeah, yeah. So like that, without the mental model of, you know, no. Like there is actual kind of baked in feedback loops to keep this a stable growing system, but a relatively stable one. Then yeah, you just don't understand at all. And so I think this mental model of the Bitcoin network is collectively auctioning off, you know, a number of Bitcoin every 10 minutes. It's designed to be every 10 minutes, and we're never supposed to, you know, get to where either that time changes or the price induces an acceleration in those mechanisms. Without understanding that, you really just can't understand Bitcoin at all.
No. And this was, an unlock for me, separating layer zero and layer one. So I guess we can move to layer one now, which is the individuals trying to get transactions included in a block. This is a completely different market, a new different layer. And I think this is where people, if you're paying attention, can really begin to intuitively understand, like, oh, this is a system of multiple markets. And for the longest time, I considered layer zero and layer one somewhat compressed, where you could, it's the mining function. You're producing blocks, people are putting transactions in those blocks. It seems like one complete market, but I think you guys did an incredible job of highlighting, no, these are actually two separate market functions that are operating between each other.
Yeah, they're coupled, right? Which is a very physicist way of describing it. But to kind of get into it, right? So if we sort of understand layer zero as this is how you distribute the supply of Bitcoin out into the world in a fair way, because it relies on proof of work, you now have to solve a much more difficult problem in some ways, which is, okay, now a bunch of miners have Bitcoin, what are they going to do with it, right? If the only thing you can do with Bitcoin is distribute it to people and nothing else, it's not really a useful currency. It's at best a kind of collectible. So you need some kind of mechanism, of course, to allow individuals to transact with their Bitcoin, to transfer it to each other. And that is, of course, what Bitcoin transactions do. And the inclusion of Bitcoin transactions from the mempool into a block is the mechanism by which Bitcoin settles transactions and allows transfers amongst users. Superficially, because both, and I call this market layer one. So superficially, because both layer zero and layer one are sort of resolved by the production of a block, it's easy to consider them to be the same thing and not see the differences. But I think there are some really important, meaningful differences. So I describe layer zero as a market between two aggregates, the entire Bitcoin network and the entire global mining industry. Layer one is a market between individuals. Individuals choose to write a Bitcoin transaction with a specific transaction fee. That's not a consensus choice. At layer zero, the entire Bitcoin network has a single asking price for the current rate, for the current price at which Bitcoin are being released. There are millions of asking, there are millions of bids from individual users for inclusion of their transactions into the next block. And each of those bids is a different transaction sitting in the mempool. Those are all created by individuals, not by consensus or by a deterministic algorithm. Similarly, each miner acts independently when they collect transactions from the mempool into their block template and attempt to mine on it. Now, yes, there are mining pools, and that sort of changes this somewhat, but mining pools are also different. And I'm hoping that, you know, next generation mining algorithms like Stratum, you know, and so on can kind of return us to a world where individuals are choosing the transactions, that individual miners are choosing the transactions they want to include in the block, much like Bitcoin functioned in its earliest days before the existence of pools. So again, layer one is really a market between individuals, between individual users for bidding their transactions into the mempool, and individual miners who have their own asking rate for the inclusion of transactions into the block template that they choose to work on. So that's a major difference, right? It's a market between individuals and not aggregates. The market at layer one is selling block space. It's not selling a predetermined supply of Bitcoin. It's selling a fixed supply of space in the next block. So there's a kind of artificial scarcity in both layer zero and layer one, but it's a different kind of scarcity. At layer zero, the scarcity is the predetermined curve upon which Bitcoin is meant to be released into circulation. At layer one, the artificial scarcity is the fixed block size limit. And so that creates price pressure on transaction inclusion, as is a controversial issue going on around these days. Every bull market, we sort of remember that Bitcoin is meant to become expensive, and we forget that in bear markets when the asking price of most miners drops as low as, you know, one sat per V-byte. So these are some differences in these markets. And frankly, miners can choose to participate in layer zero and not layer one if they wish. Anytime a miner decides to mine an empty block that has no transactions in it other than the Coinbase transaction, that's really an example of a miner participating in the layer zero market, but deciding not to participate in the layer one market by not including any users' transactions to mine in their block. So that sort of, again, indicates that these markets can function somewhat separately. But again, they are coupled, right? As I said earlier, a market in which users are releasing coins into circulation that can't be spent or transacted with is kind of a useless product. We need layer one to increase the value of layer zero, even though layer one depends on the existence of layer zero to actually settle transactions and achieve finality. A point we sort of glossed over earlier is that layer zero is really where the where the finality of the blockchain stems from. Layer zero relies in its function on the idea that all participants have a shared copy of the same blockchain. And so that is that Byzantine General's distributed consensus problem of how do you get all these participants without prior communication to agree on the contents of a data set, that's actually solved at layer zero. And so layer one benefits from that in the sense if we stick transactions into the blocks that are part of consensus, well, then we solve the double spend problem. And so layer zero solves problems and creates capabilities that layer one relies upon. But layer one adds value to layer zero, right? We wouldn't want a Bitcoin in which it was just a collectible where miners get coins that they can't spend. That makes no sense. And my argument, and broadly the argument of all of us in this conversation, is that this is the generic pattern that we have to generalize as Bitcoin grows and scales. So we have to build layers of markets that settle through Bitcoin. Lower layers create capabilities and functionality that higher layers rely upon. Higher layers add value to the entire stack and make Bitcoin even more powerful at solving problems of decentralization through market forces.
Mm-hmm. And so to hone in on the simplicity of both layer zero and layer one right now, it's simple markets. Layer zero, the network is auctioning off newly minted Bitcoin and the miners are creating hash, expending energy to produce hash, hopefully producing a hash below the difficulty target, which allows them to purchase the Bitcoin up for auction that are being distributed to the market. And then layer one, this simple market structure is you have scarce block space and individuals want to get transactions confirmed. And so they attach a fee to that transaction to entice miners to include it in a block. So you just have very simple dynamics of both layer zero and layer one. Really, it seems like there's really two factors in both of them. You have the bid and the ask at layer zero, and then you have the scarce block space and an open auctioning process to get into that block space.
And there's also a complexity shift. Like layer zero on some level, even though it's absolutely novel and it's the origin of the blockchain, I'd argue, is in many ways conceptually simpler than layer one, or maybe implementation details-wise is simpler. Like the mempool, for example, does not exist at layer zero. There's no requirement for the mempool at layer zero. There's no need for it because there's a single ask and a single bid at a time settles each ask, and there's only one order that extends the blockchain and so on. Mempool is necessary at layer one because that's where all the bids from all the users seeking to, you know, transact in Bitcoin, that's where they're stored. And that requires a peer-to-peer gossip protocol that has to get built. It requires all this extra functionality that is just not necessary at layer zero. And I think similarly, the entire Bitcoin virtual machine, the entire script language that Bitcoin transactions are written in, this is not required at layer zero either. Like there is no need for Bitcoin script at layer zero. All we're doing is distributing coins to a public key of the miner. At layer one, we need script because we want some ability to write programmable transactions to ultimately, I think, provide multi-sig-like capabilities, which are the foundation for higher layers. Whether it's Lightning or other things, higher layers often rely on multi-sig, which is to say points of coordination between multiple parties in order to create functionality that creates new behaviors and capabilities at higher layers. But all of those things are really not part of layer zero. They're really part of layer one. Their complexity is that layer one required, but they wind up becoming important at layer zero because layer zero has to validate those concepts. So before a block, even at layer zero, can be considered valid and appended onto the end of the chain, all the transactions in that block need to be validated, which is to say their scripts need to be validated and the virtual machine has to be run and et cetera, et cetera. So layer zero winds up validating the content, the semantic content of transactions at layer one, even though they're not strictly necessary for the operation of layer zero. So this is kind of like a reaching down as well as reaching upward inside the stack as these two layers become more tightly coupled to each other. And I think that's a general pattern. And maybe, Ryan, that's a good entry point for you to discuss, you know, things that Lightning needed from layer one, like I'm thinking of transaction malleability and other concepts, in order for Lightning channels to be possible, and then what capabilities Lightning then creates for even higher layers.
Yeah, absolutely. And the one point I just want to echo, though, is kind of as you're moving up in the stack, complexity generally of kind of the trades, right, the economic interactions increases. And so does, like you talked about, kind of the blockchain being the kind of common data structure for traders that everybody shares at layer zero, and then the order book, the mempool, which is kind of like the order book at layer one, like that distributed order book where everybody has, all participants in the market have kind of the shared reality, that complexity increases as we, especially keeping everybody in the same order book and having the same view of the same state. That is a complexity that grows as you get higher up in the stack, as you want things to start happening faster, right?
We could offer a few just rules of thumb that you and I have observed, right? As we move up the stack, number one, complexity of the order book increases because the number of orders increases. At layer zero, there's literally one standing order at all times. At layer one, it's approximately the size of the mempool, which is still small. At layer two, the order book is, you know, everything that's happening in Lightning, and layers three and four even get larger and larger. We start to get internet scale. So the complexity of that book grows. Second, more and more data winds up off chain, right? The mempool is an example of an entire data set that does not exist on chain. Only the settled parts of the mempool wind up on chain. In Lightning, we see whole transactions that they are never reflected on chain anywhere. Like they're never even in a mempool. They're private between two parties in the Lightning channel. So that's a general feature that we see also, right? Essentially more and more off-chain data supports the functionality of this much richer, higher throughput, larger transaction account order book, which adds complexity to the system and is harder to engineer. Like in many ways, the Bitcoin layer zero is the simplest part of the stack.
Yeah. Very well said. And like to put numbers to that, you know, at layer zero, off-chain data is negligible, right? At layer one, like standard mempool size, I think is 300 megabytes. That's kind of the shared reality. And then kind of like at layer two, if I can skip ahead to Lightning, right? Like the gossip network, every node state of the graph, their view of the Lightning network, all the channels, all the nodes, all the fees being charged, that's like a couple of gigabytes, I think. Right now. So it's interesting as that grows. But yeah, to circle back to Drew's kind of segue for me, the Lightning Network, as he said, is a network of channels where each channel is a two of two multi-sig Bitcoin transaction, right? And so in order for the Lightning Network to exist as a layer two network providing, you know, theoretically unlimited transactional scale, transactional capacity to the network, though, as you know, people are noticing, not necessarily scaling the ability for users to hold their own keys, but the transactional capacity scale was enabled by several things. One of which is just the basic ability to do multisig. Another of which is the ability to encumber Bitcoin transactions with time locks and saying, you know, this Bitcoin could not be spent until after, you know, either this absolute block height or this relative block height, 40 blocks in the future. And then the third one, which is transaction malleability. And so all of these kind of fixes in order to enable layer two, in order to enable Lightning, were kind of pushed through with soft forks in the 2014 to 2017 era, increasing the complexity at layer one, Bitcoin script, and in order for new capabilities to exist on layer two, which then kind of the demand pull on Lightning, the kind of Jevons paradox of, oh, all of a sudden now it's really cheap and easy to make Bitcoin transactions, you know, theoretically enhances and in practice has enhanced the value of both layer one and layer zero. So, you know, it's been cool to see, having joined Lightning Labs after all of the progress to like enable the Lightning Network, and the Lightning Network was always on mainnet, being able to see both kind of the growth of the network and how the growth of the network and the new capacities for Bitcoin has made Bitcoin itself more valuable, where like I think the canonical example is El Salvador made Bitcoin legal tender in 2021. Generally on the backs of the success of the Bitcoin Beach community. Shout out to Mike Peterson and kind of like Walda Sushi was involved with that community. Galoy built the Bitcoin Beach wallet. Strike, of course, with Jack Mahlers was heavily involved there. But it was kind of these enhanced capabilities of Bitcoin, the network, thanks to the underlying improvements to Bitcoin layer one that enabled layer two that kind of made that possible. So the in layer two, in the Lightning Network broadly, I think there's kind of like, if you apply the same philosophy of like trying to find really simple, scarce resources and building, you know, identifying what the trade is and then building large permissionless markets around those scarce resources and kind of that trade. You know, the first one that we've talked about, and I should preface by saying that we understand layer zero and layer one really well now, we think, because it's been 15 years. And these are like really thick liquid marketplaces with multiple market cycles of being production grade ready that we've been able to study. You know, with Lightning only going on mainnet at kind of the end of 2017, start of 2018, and then not, you know, really being production grade ready until kind of end of 2020, early 2021. You know, it's a little bit earlier in its life cycle, and there's definitely still new capabilities to flesh out, but kind of an early look at kind of the two markets is first, you know, you set up as a Lightning node, you know, what you want to do is complete a payment. And when you're completing a payment in Lightning, you're making an off-chain Bitcoin transaction with a pre-signed transaction where you want to route through multiple hubs, multiple hops, multiple routing nodes in order to get to your destination. And so because of the fact that this is a permissionless distributed network, there are many possible paths from sender to receiver for pretty much all types of payments. You know, there is a similar kind of transacting marketplace where a user wants to make a payment. They want to attach a fee to that payment in order to incentivize people to route for them. And so they are kind of bidding. And on the other side, you have routing nodes who publicly put up on the network asks where they say, I'm willing to forward a payment down this channel, and I'm willing to do so only charging 10 bips, right? 0.1% or 0.5%, or I could do it for free, right? So that kind of one marketplace for routing where you have a transactor who wants to pay, and then you have routing nodes that want to route. You know, that's, I think, pretty the capabilities for like a global permissionless market exist. And I would say today, like the mechanism by which routing nodes introduce their asks to the order book, which again, like how the order book is a mempool on layer one, kind of this public network graph is the order book on this layer two, is a gossip network. So that's a standardized format, standardized in the bolts, the basics of Lightning's technology, the spec, where every Lightning node, whether it's LND, LDK, C-Lightning, Eclair, all have a line of the same format for permissionlessly gossiping out updates to your channels. You gossip, you know, when a node shows up online, when a new channel is established, and when a fee is changed. And, you know, gossip networks are eventually consistent, so although not everybody gets the information all at the same time, similar to the mempool, eventually everybody has the same state of the network and can see, you know, Alice is charging 5 bips to get to Bob, Barb is charging 10 bips to get to Charlie, Charlie is charging 10 bips to get to Dave, right? That's 25 total bips if I make the payment. That seems like a good deal. You know, I will adjust my fee accordingly so that my payment will succeed. So that's kind of, I think, the clearest and most present layer two on the network right now. And one way that you can see this developing into a more kind of permissionless network is like today, each user calculates their route themselves, right? This is source-based routing, where when I go to make a payment, I look at the order book, my node looks at the order book itself and iterates through all the different possibilities. And each node has its kind of own pathfinding algorithm, which is, you know, essentially a order matching algorithm, if you use this terminology, where it says, looks through the order book, picks out kind of what is the best cost and also who are the most reliable counterparties that won't fail my order if they try to, which is an additional complexity on layer two that you just don't have on layer one. And once an order is selected, the sender goes and tries to make the payment. and the routing nodes let him know whether or not it succeeded or not. And that's kind of like the first kind of market at layer two is just the market for routing payments. I'll kind of pause there.
Quick break here, freaks. This rip is brought to you by Gradually Then Suddenly, a framework for understanding Bitcoin as money by Parker Lewis. I wrote the foreword to the book. I'm honored to have done so because it's the best 0-to-1 primer if you're looking for a logical explanation of why Bitcoin obsoletes all other money. Buy one for yourself and maybe a few for your friends. Go to thesafehouse.com/gradually. That's thesafehouse.com, safe spelled S-A-I-F, thesafehouse.com/gradually. Use the promo code TFTC for $5 off at checkout. Buy it now, freaks. The price of Bitcoin is going up. You need to understand it. This is the best 0-to-1 primer. Back to the show.
Yeah, I think it's a good point to pause here and just highlight the confirmation of what Drew said earlier, is these higher layers really make the lower layers more valuable at the end of the day and really extend Bitcoin's utility. And you mentioned Jevons paradox, Ryan. I think Lightning is an incredible example of that. And when I apply Jevons paradox, so for anybody listening, if you've listened to this podcast for long enough, you probably know what Jevons paradox is at this point. But just in case you're new to the show, Jevons paradox is essentially most famously applied to oil and gas markets. And the paradox is the more efficient you become with an individual unit of something like a gas molecule, it's a paradox as you think you'd use less because you're becoming more efficient, but that efficiency gain leads you to use more because it becomes so much more useful. It gives that unit of whatever it is much more utility and extendability. And I think the Lightning Network is an incredible example of Jevons paradox applied to Bitcoin UTXOs, where you can lock it up in this 2-of-2 multisig and then extend the utility of that UTXO onto the second layer and do many things with it, settle many transactions without ever having to settle a transaction at the protocol layer. And I think this market developing on top of layer one is extremely encouraging because it's just going to make Bitcoin more useful and open up the network to more use cases that will drive demand for individual UTXOs. That will likely drive up the value of Bitcoin at the end of the day.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, just on a personal level, I'd like to just underscore that point about higher layers adding value to lower layers. I would say returning to something like, you know, 2016, 2017, 2018 kind of era, I was like deeply worried about how the hell is Bitcoin ever going to scale? Like that was a thing I was always thinking about. I think I became a Bitcoin maximalist. I hate calling myself that, frankly, but like, I think I became a Bitcoin person. I started to really believe in the long-term success of Bitcoin once I learned about Lightning, because I had not imagined that such second layer type constructs with pre-signed transactions and multisig could be used to create such powerful new capabilities. And once I saw that, it convinced me like, wait a minute, okay, Bitcoin is going to win. Like, this is possible. And I think in general, that is probably true for a lot of people. Just even before Lightning existed, the fact that it might exist and it might solve these problems, that the concept of a layer two could even be possible, convinced me that layer one or layer zero and layer one itself had a lot of value and staying power.
Yep. Well said. So kind of like the other market in the Lightning Network that I think is well-developed now, and I probably should have talked about this in the preceding order, but I think it's a little abstract, so I went with the more easily understood market first. But the second market in Lightning is the market for inbound liquidity. So in order for these routing nodes that I introduced in the prior market, in order for them to forward payments, you have to have two things. One, you have to have, you know, a Lightning channel where you have liquidity on your side of the channel. And for a refresher, if folks are having trouble picturing a Lightning channel, the best metaphor or analogy for a Lightning channel is as in like an abacus, like beads on an abacus. So if I have outbound liquidity, if Dhruv and I have a channel and I have outbound liquidity, I have all the beads on the abacus are on my side. And when I make a payment, I move a bead to the other side of the abacus, to Dhruv's side. And now it's in his custody. And if I have inbound liquidity, that means that all the beads are on Dhruv's side. And so you want to have inbound liquidity as your routing node in order to receive payments and then forward them on and actually earn fees for routing. So it is a prerequisite to have inbound liquidity in order to make money routing payments on the Lightning Network. And the really interesting thing about inbound liquidity is it is the scarce resource of the Lightning Network, because in order to acquire inbound liquidity, you either have to convince somebody to open a channel to you, right, to create a new abacus with beads on their side and none on yours so that they can pay through your node, or you have to open up a channel of your own and pay through it. And actually, you have to pay to acquire inbound liquidity. So that, I think, is, you know, in the Lightning Labs, we just fundamentally believe that that is kind of the scarce resource of the Lightning Network. And it's been really interesting. There are kind of a number of different ways, as this market has more in kind of a grassroots way grown itself, unlike kind of layer zero or layer one, where there's really just kind of one market. Although I guess we could argue that at layer one, you know, now with kind of pools, like, that market is fracturing a little bit beyond just the order book. You know, there are numerous attempts, some at the protocol level, some at kind of like the centralized company level, that are trying to match up buyers and sellers of inbound liquidity, where consistent buyers is anybody that needs to receive payments. So this is routing nodes, this is merchants, this is exchanges, this is anybody on the Lightning Network that wants to receive payments. And sellers of inbound liquidity, you know, who are entities that want to monetize their Bitcoin and want to earn yield. So I think that's an interesting, like, the market is there because it's early. It isn't necessarily one market. It's many markets that kind of all interact and overlap. But I, you know, expect to see some consolidation over time as kind of one dominant market mechanism, one dominant market making algorithm kind of emerges as promoting kind of the most frictionless exchange between buyers and sellers.
Mm-hmm. With that in mind, considering the nation state of the Lightning Network, what are you seeing on the horizon that you think will really unlock the capabilities of the Lightning Network and help these markets develop? I mean, obviously you just mentioned it, like, consolidation around the order book, but are there any particular applications, particular upgrades that would really unlock and allow this market to create better structure?
Yeah, I mean, I think more than anything, in my opinion, it's going to be just demand. I think, you know, when I first really started paying attention to Lightning in 2019, 2020, right, like, these markets were, they didn't exist, right? There was, I think, like one proposal for this market structure is Nifty's dual funded channel proposal and kind of liquidity ads idea. And I think she had, like, just started working on it when I first started getting interested in Lightning. So she was obviously very ahead of the curve and trying to figure out kind of, like, in a method similar to how the mempool works, how could buyers and sellers of liquidity kind of gossip their intentions and post orders, bids and asks for liquidity. So it was, like, in its infancy then. And, you know, as demand has increased, as more entities have joined the network, as more volume has flowed through the network, that has kind of put, both created opportunities and put pressure on market participants to solve this coordination problem, right? In order to provide a really, really good user experience at a low cost for service providers, like, that is the function of these markets, is making it to where you don't have to work through, you know, kind of OTC direct connections. Instead, you can just go to a really liquid marketplace, pay a fee, ideally like a low fee, and have this problem solved for you. So I think more than anything else, it's going to be demand that really forces more. Like, consolidation isn't really the right word, because I'm not, like, promoting the centralization here, but more efficiency in these markets and kind of more depth in the market books as well. So I think, you know, obviously Lightning Labs, we think that introducing stablecoins with tapered assets is going to bring a lot more demand. to the network and a lot more volume, a lot more demand for channels. I think additionally, another thing that's interesting is going to be the introduction of all of these new so-called layer twos, the off-chain projects that are, you know, just multisigs. You know, if they actually do bring a whole bunch of users and like largely the casino kind of more back to settling on Bitcoin and interoperating with Lightning is kind of the interoperability layer, the bridging layer, because there will be, I'm sure, a lot of arbitrage opportunities across these different layer twos. Like that brings a lot more demand that all of a sudden forces market participants to be like, oh man, I need to do a better job of sourcing kind of my natural resources and allocating them to maximize this opportunity and provide a good user experience.
Yeah, I think that's the big question in my mind is what drives that demand more? Is it high fees at the base layer that force people to transact on Lightning because you can save on the transaction fees, or is it the inherent utility provided by the Lightning network just creating a all-around better user experience? And I think that's been a big theme on Twitter, which I don't think is a great place to get a sense of what's actually going on, is that Lightning's dead, it failed. But I've been using Lightning literally every day since 2019. People will be sending us sats over the Lightning network as they listen to this episode. When it comes to actually spending Bitcoin, I think the percentage of my overall spends paying a Lightning invoice compared to an on-chain invoice is probably 80-20 at this point. And obviously I'm deep in the weeds, pretty thoroughly entrenched in this industry. And so on the cutting edge, if you will, to understand that this thing, number one, exists and that it provides me incredible utility. But I think it's just a matter of time before people who aren't as in the weeds as we are begin to recognize the inherent utility of the Lightning network, and particularly being able to settle this bearer instrument instantaneously at relatively low fees compared to the base chain.
Yeah. Well, like a slight digression from the main topic of this, but just in like both of your points are correct, I think, about like high fees will get people to use it more, and then just like the broader UX improvement will induce more usage of Lightning and kind of induce that more demand. But one just interesting thing is, you know, regarding the broader Twitter conversation, the unfortunate thing, the difficult part about Lightning right now is onboarding as a self-custodial user. And particularly unfortunate aspect is that most users all of a sudden realize, oh crap, I should have onboarded to Lightning when fees are at their highest, which is the max pain time to onboard into Lightning, because each channel confirmation is an on-chain transaction. So I think that is additionally a market problem, but it's a market problem that probably needs more capabilities at layer one in order to build in a safe way. Like the old idea from the early days of Lightning is channel factories, where a LSP could open, you know, hundreds or thousands of channels off chain without needing to make an on-chain transaction and without introducing any additional trust assumptions. That's kind of the holy grail, and a big, again, Javanj paradox, where all of a sudden, if the cost to onboard a user becomes negligible instead of one Bitcoin transaction in a, you know, high fee environment, all of a sudden the ability for these businesses to go acquire users and provide a really good experience just dramatically expands. But that's kind of an area where, yeah, the layer two needs a little bit of help from layer one, in order to really do that properly and safely, just like how people, you know, could have built a version of the Lightning network without transaction malleability, but then everybody is at risk. All developers are at risk. All users are at risk. And so I do think that that's coming and will help.
Can I add a point to this that I think will helpfully tie some of these more granular details just to like the overall theme of the piece? So I think to some of your questions around this, Marty, the answer or the answers on a more and more forward-looking basis, I honestly think we'll just have to be, we don't really know. But that the focus shouldn't really be on the precise application in the first place. It should rather be on healthy market mechanisms. And I think a lesson here ought to be humility in thinking that we really understand how a lot of these mechanisms work. I mean, at least in kind of a top-down sense, right? I don't think that we really can plan exactly how these protocols are going to be used if they are appropriately decentralized, right? If we aren't going to just stand in the middle and tell people how to use them and somehow enforce that, we need to be extremely careful about the incentives. And I think much less almost precious in a way about what we want to emerge. And I remember Ryan commented much earlier in the episode that the context of the original talk that this was based on was contrasting the ethos of Bitcoin development to the ethos of crypto in kind of jumping straight to the end and almost fixing everything all at once. And I think that is still a very valid comparison to be making. But if anything, it can now be extended well beyond just trying to favorably compare to crypto and really to anything that you might want to compare Bitcoin to. Like I think, again, a lesson of a lot of the topics we've covered is that this is going to take a very long time to build. And a very long time to even understand, frankly, too. And I think it's only going to have a chance at working if we focus on designing the incentive structure as rigorously as we possibly can and at the lowest level that we can. So to return to, as Drew's terminology originally, but which we work in at various places in this piece, that it's the design methodology, I think, that matters far, far more than, you know, any potentially kind of egotistical idea, let's say, of our top-down understanding of the purpose of the system, right? What we want the purpose to be potentially doesn't matter, or just won't end up mattering if the markets aren't there to support enabling that purpose in a sufficiently decentralized manner.
I was going to say, and to that point, like, Ryan, is there anything that has materialized that maybe was unforeseen that simply came to mark because the incentive structure was a particular way?
Well, I would actually put an example that I think is squarely in your domain, which potentially controversial topic, but the layer one market between transactors and miners was very healthy and very consolidated, no fragmentation, until the last couple years with ordinals, right? Really, where all of a sudden demand started arising for these non-standard transactions that really wanted to get mined, but were not allowed into the global order book that is the mempool because of not consensus rules at the Bitcoin layer, but policy rules, which the controversial part is, if you are familiar with the American kind of system of governance, the Constitution is laws that everybody have to follow. And then the administrative state is kind of additional arbitrary rules, past guidelines passed by the executive branch that everybody kind of has to follow. And so that's kind of my mental model for consensus rules of the Bitcoin chain, or like the Constitution, or, you know, constitutional amendments would be kind of additional soft forks where the developers have actually made these happen. They've gotten consensus, everybody agrees, and the kind of policy, mempool policy, is kind of the administrative state, which is one could say they overshot a little bit on what they expected the transactors to do, and also enforced a little bit of what they wanted transactors to do, what they wanted their behavior to be. And because of that, and because of just the natural state of how the market grew, we're starting to see a little bit of fragmentation now, right? There's a little bit of people routing around the mempool and going direct to miners and mining pools because the transactions that they want to make aren't allowed into that order book.
Yeah. Out of band transactions. It's Drew, what are your thoughts on out-of-ban? Does it corrupt the incentives at all?
I think it kind of goes back to Alan's point of we don't know what we're building here, mm-hmm. and we're growing it maybe in a lot of ways, not designing it. And I actually think there's something to be said for use case based demand pull, like between layers. Like I think one of the reasons we fixed transaction malleability, we got SegWit, et cetera, is because people wanted the Lightning Network to exist, that use case was pregnant in everyone's minds and we wanted to be able to support it. So we needed to do this thing. Absent that use case, would we have had the momentum or the, you know, the necessity which drives invention to actually come up with SegWit, much less get it pushed through and activated and so on. Similarly, I think with some of the markets that we're designing in like layer two, there's this question of like, what are they for? Are they, is it actually true that they're for saving money on fees driven by, you know, ordinals degeneracy or whatever you want? Like that's a perspective and maybe that's true, but maybe I'm unique in this way. Like I tend not to spend my Bitcoin ever. So fees almost don't matter to me personally at all. As an individual, like they matter to my business. My business has a lot of Bitcoin transactions. I know that they're important to a lot of people who are transacting more frequently than me, but just a personal use case, I don't really care about fees because I never move my Bitcoin. I just sit on it. Similarly, it's like, what is the payments use case, right? Like, is Lightning really for payments? Like, we want to be able to have better UX and UI and legibility around payments. That's not a use case that resonates with me personally either, because again, I'm not buying things with Bitcoin. Like, I can buy them with dollars and I can use Venmo, and I'd rather do that because those dollars are losing value as compared to my sats. I think there is a space that we can make in our minds for what if there are unique things that you can buy with the Lightning Network that are not capable of being bought in any other way. To me, that becomes a very deeply interesting reason to spend sats. That, for example, whether we're talking about next generation social media applications like Nostr, I think it's definitely important for us to kind of include Nostr in this conversation and start to debate over it. Or for example, whether there's demand pull at layer one and two coming from ordinals theory or whatever it is. Like, I don't think sometimes the experiments or the desires even need to be real in order to create the demand pull. Like, as long as enough people think that they're going to be real, like people decide that, okay, we gotta get this thing going because I want that thing in the future. So I actually think that's really powerful as a motivator for growth, right? It's almost like a plant reaching towards the sunlight, so to speak, right? Like we don't have to understand the end goal. It doesn't even have to be the right end goal. The reality is still the case that people want things in the future and they seek to adapt the systems that they're working with now to create the foundation to get to those things. I think that's really interesting. And in fact, I think personally for me, the thing that would get me to use more Lightning and care a lot more about spending my sats is indeed higher layer applications that start to emerge that use the Lightning Network as the basis of their telecommunications or their basis of their data routing infrastructure and allow me to do and buy things that I couldn't ever buy in any other way. So that's a very compelling idea for me.
Very compelling idea and a very natural segue to Nostr. Notes and other stuff transmitted over relays and tying this back to multiple parts of the conversation where we reference the context of you two getting together in 2021 to give this presentation in the first place was comparing Bitcoin's way of building in layers to something like Ethereum, which is trying to do everything all at once. And the big theme of the crypto world last cycle was Web 3.0. Let's monetize all these different internet applications. I think the go-to use cases were NFTs, tokenized assets, and content monetization. And they approached it from, let's do it all on chain. Let's do it all with its unique token for each particular use case. And I think we would all agree that is not the advantageous way to go about designing these type of systems. And over the last 4 years, really, or probably 3 years, since I've implemented the Lightning Network into my RSS feed, distributing this podcast and the others that I host, that's where it really became clear to me that Web 3.0 is directionally correct. And yes, there should be better ways to monetize particular parts of the internet and the applications that are built on top of it, but you don't need a blockchain for it. You simply combine open source protocols like RSS, content distribution, with the Lightning Network. Now we're beginning to see that materialize with new open source communications protocol, particularly Nostr, which is a pretty dumb simple relay network that relays notes using WebSockets to give you a distributed communications protocol, which clients can be built on top of, and then to help accelerate the growth of this communications protocol. One good way to do that is to add a monetary aspect to it, to add a monetary good, a monetary layer, to create an incentive system, to create a market system where people are incentivized to build out products and interact with those products. And so with that, Alan, I'll throw it to you to get your view on Noster and the market that's developing there.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I don't want to put myself forward as in any way a technical expert on Noster. I'm really more of a, I guess, a fan, kind of an interested observer. One other thing I do think it is worth clarifying, you didn't say this, Marty, but just in case this is kind of taken out of context, definitely want to be careful in that Noster is certainly not a, you know, quote unquote layer three, at least in the sense of potentially implying that moving Bitcoin up from a layer two to, it could be increased transaction density or expressivity, and providing unilateral exit. So just want to be clear that that's not the claim we're making. That's not really even the point we're making in terms of this building in layers analogy. I think the super interesting comparison though is two similar approaches within crypto, because there is no token, exactly as you mentioned, Marty, right? It uses Bitcoin primarily via Lightning as a way of monetizing the real world costs that come with broadcasting and storing this data. And I think in trying to build the kind of infrastructure for applications involving, so far it's primarily, you know, identity and content text linked to that identity, but that we might want to have more peer-to-peer properties than's possible in, you know, if you want to call it Web 2. And I think as well, ideally, the new abilities that are unlocked, to whatever extent this is successful, in theory ought to create demand pull for Lightning, which creates demand pull for Bitcoin, and both Drew and Ryan have talked about this already. I think, like, to be honest, this follows on quite nicely, I think, from my previous comment. I'm not meaning to be too much of a party pooper. I'm just, if anything, I'm trying to be appropriately humble that I think we really just don't know if or how well Noster is actually going to work. It's just far, far, far too early. We may not even know exactly what it's going to end up being used for if it does end up being super useful. It does seem to work now, right? And there seems to be good ideas about how to use it. But I think we do have to be mindful that it also seems like it's primarily hobbyists who, for the most part, know each other. And so again, we have to be humble about if or how it can scale. But equally, obviously, at one point, Bitcoin was exactly like that. Obviously, at one point, Lightning was exactly like that. And so if it can scale, I think exactly the methodology that we've been coming back to time and time again is going to be key, right? It's figuring out how to price the real world resources with market mechanisms that are as inside the protocol as is possible, as is, you know, feasible without kind of overloading it and breaking it. I think that's its best shot. It's certainly not, it's not a token, but again, even more kind of more holistically than that, it's not a vision imposed top down that, you know, really would have to be a centralized application rather than a decentralized one.
I think it's interesting, Alan, to kind of return back to Ryan and I's 2021 conversation where we talked about what might a layer three look like and feel like. And we did conjecture that social media was definitely a use case that was interesting at layer three. The example app that I think we really focused in on was Sphinx Chat. And it's been interesting to watch how in the intervening 3 years, and I know the Sphinx Chat team is still around. I think the product is very interesting, but it doesn't have the same take up in certainly the Bitcoin community as something like Noster has. And I think it's illustrative to look at the differences between these two systems. I recently did a Stacker News, like AMA, and one of the questions that someone posed had a wonderfully evocative phrase in it that I've now taken up and want to promote, which is this notion that the internet works by putting payments within data. right? That an HTTP request is really just about the information going back and forth. And if there's to be payments made in some sort of traditional internet context, that payment information is just more data that's contained within the data that's being transferred. And of course, the underlying HTTP request in the first place, the reason you can even make it is because you're in a totally out of band process, separately paying somebody else, your telecom provider, right? Your ISP, your phone company, et cetera. Whereas the Lightning Network and something like a Sphinx chat purports to invert that relationship, right? Where fundamentally it's a payments network. And if we want to engage in general, you know, application building, we're going to put data inside of the payment as compared to putting the payment inside of the data. And I found this to be a very powerful framing for the kinds of discussions that I'm often trying to have with people. And in particular, I've used Sphinx chat as following that paradigm and saying, well, okay, the way we build totally scalable, market-driven, uncensorable, robust social media that can replace Twitter long-term is we put the data inside the payments, and the messages that we exchange are actually payments that have metadata associated with them, which become the basis of how we build our application. And that did not work, it turns out, or rather that did not scale as well as the other solution, which Noster embraced, which was, let's just kind of be traditional about this. Let's just build a traditional web application, essentially, but be very aware of Bitcoin and Lightning as capabilities that we want to integrate with. So it's a damn sight better than something that tries to start its own blockchain and token just to do quote unquote social media. It's much simpler, it's more modular, and it has maybe over time can start to look more like Sphinx chat. But I think by not forcing itself to be pure, by allowing itself to be backed by databases and traditional web technologies and still kind of functioning in the model of putting payments inside the data to a degree, it actually scaled, or at least it scaled better than Sphinx chat. I think your point, Alan, is still a fair one. It's very much still a hobbyist community. And I think there's a sort of a fundamental limit on how big something like a Noster can actually get while maintaining its principles, right? Like to grow in today's web engineering kind of paradigm, it has to become more centralized. We don't really understand how to build distributed chat applications through a relay-based architecture. And Noster's not the first community or program to try this. If folks have heard of Matrix or Element, like these are long-standing, far more capable projects that have had the same goal and ambition and have scaled, I think, probably bigger than Noster in terms of overall community size, but really haven't solved the problem. Like there is no Matrix Element-driven Twitter, and there isn't a Noster version of that either, I think for fundamental reasons. But both have scaled a lot better than the more principled approach of putting the data inside the payments, which is what something like Sphinx Chat has tried to do. And I think ultimately there's a sense in which this is wonderful esoteric demand pull, like people trying to operate at a very, very high layer in the stack that they don't really have the support structure below them yet. Like to Ryan's point on the conversation earlier, we don't really even have robust markets for routing payments within Lightning yet. So how could we possibly expect to have robust markets for, you know, large scale applications, you know, that are going to be slinging, you know, terabytes or petabytes of data over the quote unquote internet or the monetized internet, you know, every single day. So again, I think Talon's point, it's going to take a long time to get to something like this. And we don't know what it's going to look like. We don't know what all the underlying markets are yet. I still find value, if not personally, because I'm not really a big Noster user, but I still find value like intellectually in programs like Noster, because they're at least pointing people in this direction of like, yeah, you can build novel, interesting things that if not, you know, settling through Bitcoin per se, like they're telling your point, it's not really a layer three, but they're at least pointing in that direction. And that seems to be something that people value and they find interesting. So I find that very exciting and optimistic for the future.
Yeah, I totally agree. And just, you know, it's my favorite slide in our deck from 2021 was the one that said, you know, Ethereum is backwards. And if you go through like kind of the narratives of Ethereum, you know, in 2015, it was the world computer, right? You know, but then as they were building out the world computer, they realized, oh man, we need infrastructure to run this world computer. In 2017, it was all about Web3, right? Wow, well, infrastructure kind of needs payments. We can't really build Web3 yet because, you know, not everything can just be a token. We need actual value transfer. In kind of 2020, it was like, okay, now we have DeFi, so you can, you know, leverage your protocol tokens for stable coins. then we're like, ah, well, that doesn't really work. Payments need sound money. So then in 2021, it was, oh yeah, ETH is money, right? And then now it's ultrasound money. And now they're back to like stable coins and rollups, which is like, oh yeah, so we need, you know, valuable currencies and we need layered scaling, right? So Bitcoin has kind of progressed in the exact opposite manner, right? First it is, we need layer scaling. Well, first it was Bitcoin is money, just by the fact that it has a credible sound monetary policy. Second was kind of, okay, now we need layered scaling with Lightning and, you know, maybe to come additional kind of scaling mechanisms that use kind of the principles we've discussed today. Then kind of what we're talking about now is, okay, now that we have, you know, a payments layer, can we build this kind of decentralized web infrastructure? Can we build markets that solve the, you know, allocation of scarce resources of compute, storage and bandwidth, so that we can have this kind of decentralized internet infrastructure operating on top of the Bitcoin payments network. And, you know, on top of that, we do think, you know, in the long run, again, like how Webvan was 20 years before Instacart, there just wasn't infrastructure yet for a delivery, a grocery delivery service. But now Instacart, people use Instacart and DoorDash all the time because they have mobile phones. In time, we will be able to build a little computer operating on kind of the Bitcoin stack, as long as we kind of stay true to these principles as we're building these marketplaces to incentivize participants to behave properly.
And completely agree on the idea that it's way too early to tell whether or not Nostr will be successful in the long run. But I do think there are encouraging developments in tying this back to a core concept of this conversation being order books. I think that's one thing that is beginning to materialize on top of Nostr, which is very interesting and something to pay attention to. Again, it's this communications protocol that runs on these relay servers. Whether or not we will be able to, the incentives that have been set up within Nostr will be able to successfully prevent the relay infrastructure from becoming sufficiently centralized to the point where it can be controlled is yet to be determined. We think by adding Bitcoin over the Lightning Network to incentivize more people to run the physical infrastructure that you could prevent that centralization from happening. And of course, the main use case of Nostr to date over the first few years of existence has been social media, but there are interesting applications that are leveraging this communications protocol and order books that are developing that live outside the realm of social media that people should definitely be paying attention to. One example that comes to mind is this concept of data vending machines, where you use the communications protocol of Nostr to communicate a desire. That desire is communicated, sent out as a note to the relays, which is then relayed to other relays, which can be picked up by AI agents that can try to discern that desire and then communicate back like, hey, I understand what you're looking to get and I'm willing to do the work. You'll just have to pay me this amount of sats for me to actually complete this work. And so outside of social media, we're beginning to see these order books for AI computation develop. And again, whether or not they will be sufficiently distributed, sufficiently efficient is yet to be determined. But I do think it is a great example of a potential possibility of distributed markets actually developing on top of this communications protocol.
Yeah, 100%. And I do think that it's very possible because, I mean, this is all sci-fi stuff that we're talking about anyways. Why not build it for the next billion consumers on the internet who are just robots and AI agents instead of for humans directly? Like I continue to see more and more teams showing up building AI agent Lightning related stuff. It really does seem like there's a there. And certainly those entities are not going to transact en masse on Visa or on Swift or be able to get bank accounts, right? But it's trivial for them to get Lightning wallets. And I certainly think that that makes sense if the broader AI ecosystem is right, that agents are the way.
Yeah.
I think we could take this conversation in a totally crazy other direction if we want, if we talk too much about AI, but no, I totally agree. I think Bitcoin is the money of artificial intelligences, and of, I even think it's the metabolism of artificial life, but we can leave that thought. I think just returning to layer zero, I find it really interesting. A lot of the mining companies that I speak with these days, they talk about significant, like 50% of their revenues are now coming from machine learning workloads. Like they already have like absolutely intense server farms that, you know, with the power and cooling that allows them to run these like very, very intense workloads. And I think interestingly, like the AI training, the market for computations to train AI is about as hungry perhaps as the market that Bitcoin creates to sell computations for block subsidy and fees. Historically, I think that's one of the most successful aspects of Bitcoin's market is that it's constantly increasing the floor price for what we're willing to pay for computations and for energy. And until something like AI, which whether you believe this is because of a bubble or whether you believe that this is a really valuable market, or whether you just believe this is like the beginnings of Skynet coming to eat us all, or whatever is your philosophy on this, it can't be denied that like there's tremendous like budget going towards, ironically, the creation of ASICs specifically for machine learning workloads that are going to be run by Bitcoin mining companies in their existing facilities. And so now you get this interesting competition. If you're a Bitcoin miner, you now have a second market that you can sell your computational resources into. They're not the same computations, obviously. There's a little bit of a supply chain issue there. They're you know, hashes are not gradient descent or whatever. But nonetheless, these are two markets that are infinitely hungry for computation. And you have the infrastructure and facilities to do so. And so there's going to be some natural competition, even at layer zero, between AI and Bitcoin. And then I think at the higher layers, Ryan's point is a very important one, that it's very natural, I think, over the next 5 to 10 years to see AIs being maybe outnumbering, you know, human beings in terms of like just users of Bitcoin in the world, which I think is a both scary and inspiring idea.
Yeah, the point that I keep coming back to about how, you know, we need to be humble because we don't really understand anything, right? I can give more of a glass half full interpretation as well, you know, rather than that just sounding, I don't know, sad or confusing, I guess, that if we succeed in building these markets that do allow for truly decentralized protocols that can scale as well, we don't know what uses will be found, right? This is a glass half full view that we can't prevent people using whatever novel use cases we had no idea we were we were creating, because we weren't planning the top down vision of how this was going to be used. And I mean, we've touched on a few already, even at whether it's layer 0, 1, 2, right? I'm pretty sure that I've heard Drew talk about this before, that there's no way that Satoshi had any idea what the implication of mining was going to be on energy. I highly, highly doubt that the early Lightning developers, you know, would have articulated any vision around AI agents. And so I think we very helpfully extend that to Nostr as well. I've said that we don't really understand right now exactly how it works or how it's going to work, but I don't think that's at all a bad thing. That's as much should be a source of excitement.
I like the way of thinking about it is like, as we build these layers, right, each layer has the problems we set out to solve, right? Maybe at layer zero, that problem would be like, how do I build, you know, decentralized money for the internet that's a digital gold? We wind up with problems that we wound up solving because they were adjacent, and we maybe at outset didn't realize we were having to solve that problem, but we did. I think at layer zero, an example of that would be decentralized timekeeping. Like the whole notion of time chain and that being a central insight of Satoshi's, that in order to really solve the money problem, Satoshi had to solve this, you know, how do we tell what came first without a central authority problem? And that had something to do with energy, and that's very interesting. But then there's like that third category is, okay, so we built the solution and it totally winds up solving a problem that we didn't even think about even at the time we were building the solution. So I think at layer zero, that becomes, you know, energy self-sufficiency and, you know, green energy and, you know, arguably even climate change and all sorts of other, you know, things that are affected and maybe solved by the fact that Bitcoin uses a tremendous amount of energy at layer zero. I think this is absolutely true at every other layer, right? Like Lightning is ostensibly building payments systems, but I think Lightning engineers understand that they're trying to also build markets for routing. and liquidity, as Ryan pointed out. And to Alan, your point, it may turn out to be the case that in building and solving these problems, they wound up without any conscious thought solving a problem for AI agents or whatever it is. And to me, this is just more reasons to believe in and be bullish about Bitcoin, because there's this naturalness to these problems that are, you know, both adjacent and unexpectedly adjacent. I love that.
I think another great example of a unforeseen positive externality, particularly the Lightning Network, something like LNURL auth, where you can solve the problem of centralized sign-ins and passwords, where it's like, no, you need the private key to sign into the service. That's something that I did not foresee coming to market when the Lightning Network was originally marketed as this payments network to be able to transact instantly and rather cheaply on a different layer. And then it has this whole other application because you need this private public key pair to sign messages at the Lightning layer that allows you to do other things with it, like sign into a website.
Yeah, the idea generally of just, that was the thing that I'm still very excited about, but was really, really excited about with this context a while ago, is Lightning incentivizing a global kind of distributed public key infrastructure where every person all of a sudden has a public-private key pair to do more secure digital operations is incredibly exciting, with the obvious example being actually signing cryptographically each of your tweets, bringing kind of authenticity back into the internet. And like, the election's kind of just now heating up. I'm sure we're going to see a whole lot of deep fake videos and things like that. Being able to have some sort of digital signature attached to media is going to be just more and more important as time goes on. And I think that Bitcoin and payments provide the incentive to give everybody one of those keys. Now, there are kind of like security questions where you don't necessarily want to use your key for your cold storage Bitcoin to sign your memes that you're posting on Nostr. Then, you know, so there's a little bit more separation there than just the naive consolidation. But I do think it's super exciting. And I definitely want the purpose behind this talk in 2021 and the purpose behind revisiting it now is we want to encourage developers generally. The Bitcoin is, there's a lot to do here. There's a lot to build. There's a lot of exciting things to build, and they're not necessarily all just financial services or custody. There's payments, there's social media, there's et cetera, et cetera. You can go on down the line, market design, market structure, any sort of application that you have your heart set on building, we think you're going to be able to do on a Bitcoin. And there's a lot, yeah. The design space is significantly bigger now than it was 3 years ago.
And to follow up on that, I think there's this notion of the adjacent possible, right? It's like a Stuart Kaufman term of like, you know, N chemicals can build, you know, a certain number of possible molecules, or sorry, N ingredients can build a certain, or reagents or reactants, whatever they're called, there's a certain space of things that they can produce. But if you add one more thing into that mix, suddenly the space becomes not linearly greater, but exponentially greater. That they're the adjacent possible of capabilities and function is always much larger than you think it is. And I often think because Ryan and I and others have been thinking about, you know, this Bitcoin powered internet and, you know, a monetized telecommunications network and all these ideas for so many years, that at this point I've had enough time to sit there and try to poke at some of those adjacent possibles, right? That I think, to your point, Ryan, social key recovery and identity and political representation are really interesting adjacent areas that if you have something like what we're talking about, you can start to get into. But there are many other areas as well. I think meaningfully computer security is revolutionized by the new economic incentives that are brought into play by a Bitcoin-powered internet. I think intellectual property doesn't exist anymore if we have a Bitcoin-powered internet. I think the connections with AI and digital life and the things which live within this Bitcoin powered internet are very powerful. So I totally think it's inspiring. And I think you said this earlier about Web3 being directionally correct, Marty, like absolutely. I think it's one of the things that's sometimes hard for Bitcoiners to admit, but ETH people were totally right that this stuff is valuable. They were just completely wrong about how to build it. But that's okay. we can learn from them and they can learn from us. And at the end of the day, like, Bitcoin is going to win. It has already won at layer one, which was, I think, another point that Ryan, you and I made back in 2021. And it's just a matter of, over the coming decades, sort of seeing how that win manifests in additional layers and through this, you know, space of the adjacent possible as Bitcoin, you know, sort of devours the world as markets and decentralized systems replace centralized service providers as the methodology that human beings use to solve problems.
Yeah, and I'm very happy we're having this conversation because, Drew, when you're just saying that, it made me think we do have a lot of headwinds, particularly on the narrative front, because a lot of this stuff is not intuitive. In fact, it's counterintuitive. And the two examples that we've talked about in this show that really highlight this are the energy usage and you just mentioned securing our systems, because historically, Bitcoin's energy usage has been looked at as a bad thing. People don't understand it, and they emotionally write it off as a bad thing because they just see the amount of energy that's used and say that has to be bad. And then conversely, with computer security, the whole ransomware meme that's been going around for many years now is that Bitcoin enables this. It's really not. No, Bitcoin doesn't enable it. It just highlights how bad it is. It can actually fix the problem by creating an incentive to actually create secure systems in the first place. Bitcoin simply created a way to make it so you could levy ransomware attacks as you get paid in this permissionless distributed monetary asset, where if you were to do that before, you do a ransomware attack and say, hey, wire funds to this account. It's like, that's not going to work because the banking system will stop that. Bitcoin simply highlighting that these problems exist now because they're more easily exploitable now that Bitcoin exists.
Yeah, there's almost like a biological analogy there, you know, like immune systems and stuff are always being attacked constantly, all the time. And that's how they're efficient. And that's why they work so well, is because they constantly have to fight off pathogens all the time. You know, I think like cells in your body are developing cancer constantly, and yet your body's self-regulation mechanisms are always dealing with that all the time. I think there's something to be said for when a system enables attacks to be profitable and easy, then the system will be attacked all the time. And if it's to survive, the immune response of the system is to become massively more robust. I think that's very different than centralized systems. Centralized systems can, through the powers that they gain by central coupling to, you know, administration or judiciary or law enforcement or economic clout, they can make it hard to attack them. They can make it difficult to attack them. And as a result, they don't get attacked that much, which means they're able to be brittle or grow brittle over time in ways that are hard for us to see because they're now sort of endemic systemic parts of the world. We don't realize how fragile they've become. And that's very different than biology, right? So I think there's a sense in which Bitcoin kind of brings a certain degree of biological engineering into computer science, into decentralized systems engineering, into economics, as compared to the more traditional mechanical engineering kind of spirit of building something from design, from first principles, and architecting it a certain way, and then being confident that it's going to last forever.
Yeah. Beautifully said. What happened? Did we lose everybody? We lost Ryan. Ryan had the drop, which I think is a good signal that the show may have to come to an end soon. Gentlemen, is there anything that we didn't touch that we should wrap up on, Alan?
No, I don't think so.
No, we covered
maybe
a lot
of territory. I should throw in just finally that I meant to say this at the start, but we moved on a bit too quickly. Just thanks to Ryan and Drew again for the talk that got all of this started, which I do think, by the way, people incidentally should watch that as well. It's not like this piece we're putting out is in any way a replacement for that. I did the reason I wanted to bring it up earlier, though, I just find it funny that I think Drew and I have kind of oddly different recollections of the path from there to here, but you know, we've come to a decentralized consensus on it anyway in terms of getting this piece out. But my recollection, though, is that I maybe I'm just mistaken about this. I don't know. I don't think I wanted to get the ball rolling on this piece until much, much later, because in my mind, at least, I spent probably about 2 years just telling people to watch this talk. I think I did also say to Drew and Ryan, like, it would be great if, you know, if you guys wrote this down. The efforts on my part to get it to this state, I think, are a lot more recent. So Ryan's dropped off now, but thank you, Ryan, when you hear this, and thank you, Drew, for getting the ball rolling in the first place.
And I would co-sign that. Thank you, Drew, for all the intellectual power you put into thinking about the many different areas of the space, whether it's auto waves, Bitcoin in space.
Bitcoin is the thermometer. Have you done that one yet? Maybe not the best time to bring this up at the very end of the episode, but you should. That's another episode you can do at some point, Mari.
No, not. I'm saying this earnestly, not trying to blow smoke up your ass. Again, I said it earlier, but I think reading this piece a couple times really helped me get a better conceptual view of how the different parts of the Bitcoin stack interact with each other. And I think this concept of creating these markets at different layers is very powerful and is a great heuristic from which anybody building in the space at any layer should apply when thinking about what they're building and what they're actually bringing to market. I think it'll provide much more clarity in terms of the use cases that you will be able to fulfill. Is thinking about these different market structures that exist at different parts of the stack. And really highlights something I've always had intuitively, which is that I think Bitcoin is more of a economic revolution enabled by tech instead of a tech revolution that creates this economic revolution.
The blockchain doesn't matter. Like, it's cargo culting when people are like, oh, we got to use a blockchain to solve the problem. The blockchain does nothing. It is just the record of the economic incentives that really solve the problem. And that's always been kind of like the vision. I think that Ryan was really the one that opened my eyes to that kind of way of thinking about it, in the sense of his little sort of pithy phrase of what we mean by decentralization is market driven. Like, that really got me to start thinking about, like, well, okay, like, what is it that makes Bitcoin decentralized? Well, it must be the market. Like, what is the market? Who is trading what for what? Like, how does it work? So it kind of really set me off on thinking about this stuff. And just returning to your point about narrative, Marty, like, this is both such a strength and weakness of the Bitcoin project and community. We don't have the equivalent of the Ethereum Foundation or Vitalik coming up with a roadmap for us to all follow over the next 10 years, which may be right or may be wrong, but at least is something that everyone can point at and be like, well, that's the plan. That's what we're doing. I would say that a lot of what we've talked about today maybe sounds intuitive to people that have been in Bitcoin for a long time. And my hope, if I have one in these conversations, is that people who've been here for a while will hear what we're saying and be like, yeah, that's what I thought was going to happen too. I just maybe never said it in so many words. I never maybe, you know, put that out there. And conversely, by putting it out there, my hope is that the people who maybe haven't come to these conclusions because they're newer, they're just got to Bitcoin, will sort of think of this as loosely, like, not the roadmap, but at least the direction that we think is inevitable, not the direction that Alan and I and Ryan and you are telling people that they have to follow on some sort of schedule and here's how to design it and here's how to build it, but more just like, look, we've already won. It's going to happen. It's probably going to look something like this. Like, get ready for it and maybe plan accordingly. And I think we should maybe repeat, Alan, the way the article ends and the way that Ryan and I's talk ended here at the end of this conversation, which is, if you're in Bitcoin, you know, open your eyes to what's coming and embrace it, be excited. Don't pretend that Bitcoin is just about money. Like, it is money, but money touches everything in the world, and therefore Bitcoin is about everything just as much as it's about money. And then conversely, if you're not into Bitcoin, if you're someone on the Ethereum side of this who thinks that Bitcoin is, you know, stodgy and old and not Turing complete, and therefore its blockchain is already, you know, outmoded or whatever, maybe pause in that thinking and reflect on the kind of layered solution of markets providing truly robust decentralized services like we're describing today. And consider that if you value the thing you're building, if you really want to solve that problem that you're so passionate about, because I really do believe a lot of people in Ethereum are passionate and intelligent and worthwhile. If you really want to solve that problem, consider solving it using Bitcoin.
That's a perfect way to end it. Gentlemen, thank you for all your work. Thank you for joining me today. We got to do this again. I can't wait for the next iteration of Orion Gentry and Dhruv Bansal collaboration. May take another 5 years, but I'll be waiting. I'll be here.
We're adding Alan to the team. It'll make it even better.
We're going to do a presentation at Bitcoin 28. We're working on it. Don't worry.
Okay. Low time preference. I'm here to wait.
Exactly.
Gentlemen, enjoy the rest of your day. Thank you. That's all we got today, freaks. Peace and love.